Thank you and welcome. But, before I introduce my panellists today, can I just check amongst everyone here who attended any of the events last weekend? So what we can assume in terms of... Okay, what did you see?
I was here on the first night, Friday.
Okay, and this lady at the back?
I saw Vince's because I was assisting Chris.
Okay, and what, the lady here? No, okay, okay, and you weren't here, and no, okay, so we're kind of evenly matched. Well,
are you all happy so far? Or do you want
okay, can you see? All? they might come closer once they see that we're not threatening. Well, I'll just introduce myself. I work for The Wire magazine, which is a music magazine, and I also write about performance and live art for various other publications. And one of the things that I'm interested in, what I write about, is performance and the performance of art in general, and that not only encapsulate what music might be, but also what can it do and how it's put on the stage, and also the cultural and the political and the ethical ramifications of what it is that we see on the stage. And in my discussion with my colleagues here this evening, I hope we can sort of widen our discussion to involve all kinds of aspects of what they do, and hopefully we'll have lots of interesting questions from you all as well. So I'm just going to do things completely alphabetically. It makes things much simpler. This is Orlando Goff. Orlando is a musician. He's a composer. He's got a lot of experience in opera and in television work. But one of the things he also does, he's the musical director of a choir called The Shout, which is a big and innovative choir which does a lot of music theatre and a lot of live art. And one of the things that Orlando presented last week was called Flam, which was indeed a piece of work which was made by Emma Bernard here. And you'll see a few little snips of that later, but we'll come back to that. And then we have Chris Green here, who last week presented his one-to-one in a cupboard, which is actually, or rather, a very small dressing room, and it was a piece called The Singer, which was something that you already showed staged in Stratford. On Avon, as opposed to East London.
Yes.
Isn't it? And
a reworking of that. Yeah.
And Chris has many strings to his bow. He writes for the radio, he writes plays, he's done a lot of television work, but he's certainly famous in cabaret and the sort of nightclub world for two characters that he does, called Tina C and Ida Barr, the latter being the hip-hopping Edwardian granny who, you know, well, when
that's right, I remember you from there.
Who, when he's in full effect, is quite extraordinary. And then lastly, at least in terms of alphabetical order, we have Kazuko Hoki, who is a Japanese live artist, and she came to England in the 1978, I do beg your pardon. And one of your first inventions was the Frank Chickens, who were a sort of live art cabaret act, which continue to this day, and I think they've probably involved every single Japanese woman who's sort of passed through London. And they're an experience, an absolutely delirious and wonderful experience to behold. And Kazuko has done a lot of has got a strong body of theatre work under her belt, but and a lot of it that uses song as well. But I'm going to just go back alphabetically, and so we're going to talk to Orlando about your work, and you do. With the shout, I'm particularly interested that it's a chorus experience, and it seems to me that our generation is possibly one of the first generations that don't have an experience of choral singing in any shape or form. We don't, by and large, we're an agnostic society, at least in Britain. We don't go to church. I don't know what the status of school assembly is like, but there are not very many opportunities where people sing together, perhaps in football matches, I'm not sure, and that's only a very small segment of the population anyway. So I'm particularly interested in the dynamics of what happens when a body of people come together and they sing as a chorus, and what that means as a social entity these days.
There's a slight sense of panic in the country at the moment, I think, about the fact that we don't really sing much anymore together. And so the government actually has kind of instituted various little schemes to kind of encourage people to sing. But they're slightly kind of panicky because there doesn't seem to be any kind of obvious social background to them. Whereas when we all used to go to church, it was quite obvious why we were singing. So you have to kind of invent the background for singing. And my own version of inventing the background to singing was to think of it in a theatrical kind of way. So that when I started this choir that I run, The Shout, I always had it in mind that it would be a theatrical experience when you saw it, that we would do things which looked a bit like concerts, but they wouldn't quite be concerts. They would be more than that. There would be some theatrical element. We would do explicitly kind of music theatre pieces, and we would also do site-specific pieces. Because I've always felt that there is inherently something very theatrical about singing. Even if you sing in the bath, it begins to be theatre. And I think that, for instance, if you watch somebody on stage, on a concert stage, singing, then it's hardly theatre, it's somebody singing. If there is, listening to that person, also sitting on stage, three people sitting behind a table, listening to the person singing, then it's beginning to become theatre, because you can't help wondering what those people are thinking about the person singing and how she's or he is doing it. And then it seems to me that if those three people themselves start singing, burst into song, then we've got theatre. And so I suppose that what I have always been thinking about is giving a context to singing which makes it more explicitly into theatre. And I've done that mostly through this choir, The Shout, which has 16 people in it, often working with huge quantities of amateur singers, 500-600 amateur singers, to make big theatrical pieces and site-specific pieces. A couple of years ago, I thought, how megalomaniac is all this? Why are there always so many people in these pieces? And why don't we just work with a couple of people and investigate those things, those ideas, but in more detail? So we decided to do a piece which we called Flam. Mm. And Flam is the meeting of two women in a cafe. This was the piece that we showed last week. The two women are two women from The Shout who I've worked with for a long time before, but I thought it would be very interesting to work with just the two of them in more detail. So we made this piece, and I'm just going to show you a couple of minutes of it, just to give you an idea of the sort of thing that it's about. And so on. So you we set up a situation there which is kind of recognisable, except it's immediately subverted by the fact that they start singing instead of talking to each other, and it's subverted by the fact that the lyrics are sort of semi-understandable and you kind of know what they're talking about, but it's not totally obvious. And then it's subverted again by the fact that they're wearing the same jumper, and maybe they're
sisters or maybe they're friends, but we don't quite know yet. So we've got quite an ambiguous situation, which is very kind of playful. And the rest of the piece, which is about 15 or 20 minutes long, is like a series of games that these two women play, some of them which are genuinely kind of exuberant and playful, and some of them which are quite nasty. And I think perhaps I've always... Well, I've done a lot of work with dance companies, and one of the things I like about watching dance pieces is that the kind of emotional tenor of the piece can actually turn around in about half a nanosecond. It's slightly more difficult to do in a play. You have to kind of prepare it. And I love the way that in a dance piece, two people who appear to be in love at 1 second are beating each other's brains out the next second. And there's something very interesting about that, which I would like to get in this piece, that you don't know quite where you are with these two, and that's rather heightened by the fact that they're singing, I think, and that the way that they sing emphasizes the kind of ambiguity of what we're seeing. It was quite obvious that this is a theatre piece and needed a director, because although Melanie and Rebecca are very good performers, we couldn't do it by ourselves, so we asked Emma to come and direct it so that it becomes more interesting theatrically. And we worked on it in various different ways. Sometimes we did it with the music leading. Yeah. Something that I'd written became the basis of what happened. And then later on we get a completely different kind of scene where it's led by what is being said. There is a sequence, for instance, where it becomes obvious that Rebecca's pregnant, and that Melanie, who's clearly had several children and knows how to do it, gives her a kind of lecture on what she should be doing and how to do it. And then they practice having a baby together, and which ends with this kind of big explosion of Georgian-type singing, so that the piece is able to be very, very unpredictable.
And it's very nice, but it draws in. I like the way you mentioned this childbirth guru, but it draws attention to the performance of everyday life. And okay, that you know that these women are singing ostensibly nonsense with one or two recognisable words that come along as flashpoints. But there's an enormous tension built in. You can see them absolutely, the friction. Rubbing up against one another, and I don't know whether it ends with the short one, Rebecca braining Melanie, but But what were the particular challenges for you as a directing a piece like this, where the movement of it is so subtle?
I mean, I think for me, what's interesting about it as a conversation between two women is that it's a kind of conversation where you have a thought, and instead of putting that thought to the back of your mind and carrying on with the proper conversation you're having in the cafe, you actually follow that thought through. Mm. So that physically you start doing something or seeing something or behaving in a way that is utterly inappropriate for that kind of naturalistic situation in the cafe. And I think, for me, that's a real liberation, actually. Mm-hmm. That's not a challenge. That's great fun that you can kind of just take, and in the dance piece way that Orlando is saying, take something and take it to its extreme. I think the challenge is always that you're working with a text. You know, when you have a piece of music, it's a piece of music with dots on a page. And if you're someone like me who doesn't read dots, you kind of go, "Oh, this exists already, and I have to do something with it." I think what's very good about this process was that we were allowed to work both ways, and so that if the kind of physical input and the ideas input could come in, it wasn't a simple kind of staging of some pieces of music. Mm. It was much more of a collaborative thing. And also because as singers, they are so playful and so skilled that the joy of doing it is about playing the game where you make it look incredibly easy, you know. That's kind of what they do. Yes, I can drink a glass of wine and fiddle with my handbag, make a phone call, and sing something incredibly complicated.
Was the libretto written by you totally in isolation from the two singers, or was there a certain amount of collaboration?
Well, because I'm a bloody composer, I wrote some stuff first.
Yes.
So that there was a kind of, there was, as Emma said, a text that we based it on. But actually, it was quite clear that we were going to take that apart when we made the piece, and that we were going to introduce stuff from another angle. Mm. So, and then there was bits of text which were improvised, and bits of text that we wrote later. Mm. It wasn't all just, bam, here it is.
Yeah, and a couple of instances actually where it happened that it would be really good if you sang something like, oh, I don't know, and they would go, oh, well, what about?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that happened.
Yes, because there's certain associations. You can see that, that there are certain associations in the stream of words that come through, and you think, oh, yes.
Yes,
that's
me. But then there was a point where we decided to do a section which was about copying the other person, but immediately, so that as soon as in this case Rebecca starts singing, Melanie just copies everything that she's doing, the way that she's singing, what she's doing with her body and everything, at the closest possible interval afterwards. Now, and it became obvious that you wouldn't want to write something for that. It was much more fun if it was a well-known song, or maybe not such a well-known song, but a song that Rebecca knew that Melanie didn't know, and that so she would be desperately trying to keep up. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that's a very interesting scene, actually, because watching somebody imitating somebody, immediately imitating somebody who's singing, which of course is incredibly putting off anyway, it makes you look very carefully at what they are actually doing with their bodies, and then it becomes a game about seeing if you can put the other person off, so that the person who's following is trying to do it at such a short distance that it's actually really annoying for the person who's leading, and the person who's leading is doing little kind of is holding stuff back so that the other person is not quite sure what's coming next. And so it becomes this game, but it's a game which I think reveals, quite interestingly, what you're actually doing when you're singing, what the theatricality of the singing is.
Yes, yes. One of your earlier projects, which we chatted about before, was something that you did with the Belgian director, Alan Platel, which was The Shout. Not only The Shout, which is your London-based choir, but it was a piece. It was a large enveloping piece. Well, why is it that I sing?
Yes, or even because I sing.
Because I
yes,
sing. That's yeah. right. I'm sorry for getting the title. But basically, this was a huge choral piece staged in the Round House, in which you took choirs from all over London in all shapes and forms. So you might have a WI choir of Wandsworth Town, or there was a deaf choir.
Yeah.
I think you had the London Gay Men's Chorus. I remember going to see them rehearsing, and you can remind me of a few others. But I was particularly interested in the way that was a bringing together of community, and what that was doing, and how you found a song, if you like, or a number of songs to suit not only that homogenised mass, but a way that to give them a way of communicating with each other.
Yeah, it was
so there was a to and fro. Because you had hundreds of singers there, didn't you?
It was about 600 singers. Yeah. It was quite interesting, actually. The genesis of the project was that Michael Morris of Art Angel had decided a long time ago that he wanted to get Alan Platel, the choreographer, to come and do a piece in England.
Mm.
And Alan wouldn't do it because he only works with people in Ghent, which is his hometown. Mm. And the only way that Michael could persuade Alan to do a piece in London was to let him do a piece with choirs. Alan said, I will only come and do it if it's with choirs, because I think that there is something that's very, very interesting there. So it had to be a piece with choirs in it. And Alan is a choreographer, so on the face of it, that was a very, very strange choice. So we did this piece in the Roundhouse with 16 choirs, and Alain had a very, very subtle kind of relationship to the piece, in that he did very little except talk to the people in the choirs and find out who they were and why they were singing and what they were doing and why they wanted to be in this piece and so on, and ask some very kind of tricky, pertinent questions which he could do with great kind of lack of guile, apparent guile, because he had such a beautiful kind of Belgian accent, and that was all fine. So he kept, so he's asked very, very difficult questions for instance, I mean, the deaf choir, he kind of said, you're a deaf choir, surely that's taking the piss, isn't it? You know, but somehow when he said it, it was, didn't sound like that. And so what he wanted to establish, really, was why all these people were doing it, why they wanted to be in choirs and what they were aiming for. And so when we brought the piece together, what it became actually about was the choir singing to each other. Mm. I mean, there was an audience there, but really it was about the choir singing to each other. And that became really interesting when the choirs were very contrasting and not necessarily compatible at all. Yeah. Probably my favourite moment of it was when the gay men's choir started singing and the Congolese Christian choir, who were kind of hidden away by that time, they were sort of semi-darkness, but you could see what they were doing, simply started praying, which actually was a very polite version of what the Kingdom Choir, a fundamentalist group, did, which was to simply refuse to be in the room with the gay men's choir. And so we were beginning to kind of get something going there. Earlier in the piece, we'd had all the choirs singing in Arabic, which was interesting because one of the choirs was the Jewish male voice choir. And so people were having to make serious adjustments in order to be in this piece. And it was, without wanting to be pretentious, but being pretentious nevertheless, it was like a really interesting microcosm of kind of London society. Well, UK society, really, was to see these people kind of jostling around this multicultural kind of event. That for me was really very, very interesting because it pointed absolutely directly to the relationship between singing and society and what it can do and what it can't do.
As a matter of interest, can you remember any of the reasons people gave Alan for why they do sing? I mean, I'm not talking about professional singers here, I'm talking about amateurs who give up their evenings after work to go to the Hackney Singers or whatever it might be and invest quite a lot of time and energy into doing.
Once you've seen a choir, we went to see all the choirs rehearsing, and once you've been there for a couple of minutes, you know that it's not really a question that needs asking, actually, because you can see that there is this absolutely amazing, kind of unique, I think, almost sense of community immediately with a choir. There is also, of course, a huge amount of neurosis and cliques within choirs. I mean, God knows, they're not this kind of panacea for great society. It's terribly full of kind of snobbery and anxiety. You know, oh God, she's better than me, or I'm better than her, and what are we doing here, and they can read music and I can't, and so on. But you do realise that actually, that from a social point of view, it is an absolutely, basically a magnificent thing to do, and that people who otherwise wouldn't necessarily have much in common can find this amazing, absolutely immediate common ground and understand what each other's on about. And that actually also the physical experience of singing is actually kind of releases whatever it is that makes you happy. You know, it seems to work very, very nicely.
I'm struck by this sort of secular need for community singing and the way we construct opportunities to do it anyway. You know, you can think of, you know, a rock concert and torch songs and everyone singing along at a rock concert or at a football match or the thing that's always sticks in my mind is that these big events that they have annually at the Royal Albert Hall called the Messiah from Scratch and things like that, in which you will get, I don't know how many seats the Albert Hall has, it's something like 4,000, would you say?
Yeah, 5,500.
Where they fill it with every single person comes with their copy of the Messiah, and they have a few professional soloists, and everybody sings. The soloists do their soloists, and then when the Hallelujah chorus comes along, you know, you have this 4,000 strong Hallelujah chorus, which, you know, raise the roof or break the glass, depending. But it seems to me an extraordinary thing and a very, very emotional
It's automatically emotional, and that's what's interesting about singing. You don't have to sing in a kind of emotional way. You don't have to be Edith Piaf. There's something about inherently about singing which I think is emotional. Mm. That's a very, very approximate kind of thing to say, but there is something because of what you... It's particularly when you're doing it, mm-hmm. I think, but also when you're listening, that it just goes straight there to the heart.
Is it also about, you know, to use this cliche, as sort of about finding a voice within yourself which is quite different from the normal voice with which one's... the normal voices with which one speaks in everyday life, and the way... And finding a source of power in your way. If you speak loudly or you shout loudly and you hit the voice in a particular way, your body resonates, and the vibrations in your body really do resonate, and it's extraordinary.
I think that's absolutely true. But I think that talking about choral music, for a lot of people in amateur choirs, that's not what they're there for. They're there because they know that their voice in itself is not a particularly interesting instrument, but actually with other people they can make something. I don't mean to sound sentimental here, but it's absolutely about being part of something which is much bigger than you can do. So if you go to somebody in an amateur choral society and say, could you take a solo in there, they'll go, absolutely no, please don't do anything like that to me, that is absolutely cruel. But what they want is a feeling that the person next door is singing the same thing. So to an extent, yes, you're finding your own voice, but actually what you're also doing is sort of saying, this person here has got the same kind of voice as me, and together we can make something. And it does sound sentimental, but actually it's what choral music, I think, is about. And it's about, and because choral music is also explicitly about listening as well as doing, and because you can't keep in tune unless you listen, you know. When you're playing an instrument, you can be much more bloody-minded, whereas when you're singing, there's no way out. You have absolutely got to find a way of listening to what everybody else is doing in order to be able to make a decent effort yourself.